Welcome to Bicom's Hydrogen Weekly Podcast. My name is James Serene, Bicom CEO. Delighted to be joined by Caleb Bendor and Richard Payton. Israel, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon.
So really the big news this week is the fact that the Israel Defense Forces has a new chief of staff, the 22nd chief of staff of the Israeli Defense Forces, Aviv Kochavi, which literally translates Kochavi as a star. He was always, some say, sort of marked out for greatness as the kind of commander that would end up being the next chief of staff. I mean, Richard, could you tell us a bit about what kind of soldier, what kind of commander he is?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think you're right. He's kind of excelled everything that he's done so far. He comes from the paratroopers brigade, which has seen a lot of the kind of the infantry unit that has seen other, probably the most chief of staffs coming from that unit. But he went through the paratroopers. He served in a number of very senior command positions, including Northern Command, including head of military intelligence. He also has a master's degree from Harvard. He's also a vegetarian, which is also rare amongst the IDF top brass. In terms of his personality and character, he's kind of seen as a combination of a very strategic thinker, almost kind of to an academic level, but also from his paratrooper roots as a very tough and determined commander. He's seen as a temperament, as more extrovert. Kind of the watchword which keeps being repeated is sophistication and creativity. He was known as, when he was in the intelligence branch, he made some serious changes there, really kind of bringing the IDF intelligence through with research and cyber capabilities. When he was head of Northern Command, he was the commander that came up with the idea of the partnership program to help alleviate the humanitarian suffering on the Syrian side. But I think to a large extent we will see, and he was also, as being part of the general staff for the last few years, partner to the decisions, and there will be an element of continuity to a great degree, but obviously dealing with a lot more different strategic challenges that Israel is facing at the moment.
I read today that he's sort of renowned as someone who's an innovator and someone also who likes to break things apart and then build them up again. Like, so he's like a big reformer, I suppose, who likes change. I mean, is that something that you'd say is a fair assessment of him?
I've heard similar, the kind of the reforming nature of the jobs that he's done before. The question is whether, as I said, because he's been part of the chief of staff, how much he will change. I mean, there are institutional changes that are kind of being debated about within the IDF, manpower issues, especially kind of dealing with the motivation of a younger strata of commanders to keep them in the IDF that he will have to deal with, as well as the strategic challenges.
And it's interesting change at the top, isn't it? We've got a chief of staff who we know is not the prime minister's sort of number one candidate. He takes over during an election campaign. As I understand it, his deputy has not been the deputy before. The head of military intelligence doesn't come from the intelligence branch. I mean, to what extent can this sort of shake up really affect continuity?
So you're right that there are new people in those top positions, but Aviv Kochavi is no stranger to this. He has served on the general staff for a number of years and will be familiar with it. And obviously, the reason why they extended this handover period to this week was to allow a suitable time since his appointment to get integrated into the system and have a suitable handover period with Eisenkot. And obviously, I mean, even though they're in an election period, Netanyahu is the most experienced hand at all this, and he is, at least in the short term, still around and still there leading the security cabinet. So there's no, at least the sense here is that there's no great worry that this is being handed over to novices.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's very interesting in looking at some of the commentary today in the Israeli newspapers is that it gives you a chance to really compare the strategic environment that Gadi Eisenkot faced when he took over in early 2015. And if we cast our minds back to that and compare that to the present, we had an Iran nuclear deal that was a few months away from being completed. Iran was in negotiations with the P5+1. Hamas had just suffered a major blow in Operation Protective Edge, and there was not any hostilities there that certainly seemed imminent. Syria was deep in a civil war. The Russians hadn't really yet intervened gained in any strength. And, you know, the Syrian civil war was a real stalemate at that point. And now if we look at the strategic environment, it's vastly different. We've got a very different situation with Hamas, where we've had an extensive conflict as close as November. We've got a very serious situation with Israel attacking Iranian targets in Syria. And, you know, in Ghazi Eisenkot's departure interviews, he talked about this with great candidness, and also talking about the history of that operation. We have a situation with Hezbollah, you know, will it now build up this missile arsenal of precision-guided missiles in Lebanon now that perhaps more of its fighters are freed up from Syria? It seems like there's much more change in those last few years. The strategic environment has really altered in a very significant way. I mean, Israel's deterrence, you know, is still very strong. But I think, you know, if we could discuss each of those in turn, I mean, it is a vastly different strategic environment, isn't it, now, just 4 years later?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct, James. I think the Russian entry into the Syrian civil war, which I think before it happened was not really expected, has really changed the strategic complexion of what Israel can do and how Israel can act. I think you're absolutely right. The Gaza 4 years ago was still tense, but it had just followed the war and there was a much stronger Israeli deterrence. And similarly, so the threat that Hezbollah poses now, it's still, you know, we shouldn't pretend that there weren't significant threats facing Israel 4 years ago. But the attempt by Iran and Hezbollah to upgrade its missile capacity into more precise missiles, which is perhaps the largest strategic threat that Israel faces going into 2019, is something that wasn't there several years ago. I think the other thing that's worth pointing out, and we've talked about our forecast before, and in some ways every year in our forecast we've said that Abbas is he's getting older. We don't know when, but at some stage he will depart the scene, and then we always question what that will do to stability on the West Bank. But I read today, and I think it's very true, whether it's this year or next year, at some stage probably during Kochavi's term as chief of staff, there will be a significant change in the leadership of the Palestinian Authority on the West Bank, and no one quite knows what that's going to lead to. So yes, absolutely, the challenges facing Kochavi in many ways are more intense and serious than the strategic situation facing Israel 4 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, let's reflect actually a little bit on those interviews that Gadi Eisenkot did over the weekend. I mean, this is always a sort of set piece, isn't it, when the chief of staff retires. They do their sort of departure interviews, and there's almost an established procedure for this, and they will sort of open up and provide commentary, perhaps give a little bit of detail about incidents or operations that have been actually things that Israeli military have been quite tight-lipped about during the tenure of the chief of staff. But it was particularly significant, wasn't it, what he said about Israel's, I suppose, fight against Iranian forces in Syria. He really provided a lot of detail about how that operation developed from 2017 onwards, about the fact that there was a real continuous and intensive battle going on there. I mean, he talked about thousands of bombs being dropped. He talked about Iran's plan to try and have 100,000 Shia militias and other armed personnel in place in Syria. And he talked very openly about Israel's extensive operations to combat that. I mean, what do you think the thinking was, both of you, about why sort of do that now? Was that a way of trying to say that this phase of that conflict is over? Was it just to try and show the Iranians, you know, Israel's being upfront about it as a form of deterrence? What did you make of that?
I agree. I mean, there were fascinating revelations, certainly for the civilians. One can presume that amongst other military and government officials, most of this was known. I mean, we've discussed this and written about it to a great extent as well. And often similar to other Israeli and international media, would always have to preface stuff with according to foreign sources. But it was quite clear that things were happening on quite a regular basis, certainly in the strikes around the Damascus area and warehouses and other cargoes, convoys of weapons. So we knew much of it, but you're right. I mean, it was a fascinating insight of just how much detail he was able to speak about. And the question, I mean, I don't have a good answer as to why the timing of it has come around, apart from that it was the end of his tenure. And the question we're all asking is kind of, does this mean that we're at the end stage of this process? And I think Israeli commentators are kind of split over this. I mean, they're also split over the Russian role now about, obviously, since the incident when the Russian plane was shot down, and there's been a decrease in this. Some have suggested that, you know, that there is a change of approach from the Russians. Others have said that, look, even over last weekend when there were further strikes in the Damascus area, and the Russian response was pretty muted. And that's kind of understood by some that as an acquiescence, that the Russians understand Israel's need to carry on in such a manner. There was also a distinction and a criticism that following the Gadi Eisenkot's interview, Prime Minister Netanyahu also went on record and spoke with specific details. And a distinction was made here between the overall kind of big picture numbers that the Eisenkot was discussing, and if kind of over the last year or two, and the specific kind of day after talking about the strike and really losing the whole facade of the ambiguity, which has been part of the policy over the last few years. So I think we can only speculate now where this will take us in this new realm.
I think there is an interesting argument that actually the ambiguity, you know, even though everyone kind of knew that it was Israel who were hitting these areas, the ambiguity served an important purpose because it didn't put too much pressure on Assad or the Iranians to respond. And there's an interesting argument that actually ending the ambiguity does not necessarily serve Israel's purposes. But I think another reason that perhaps Eisenkot did publicize this is I think there's an attempt to put pressure on Iran domestically for Iranians to see how much effort and money, and in some way how much blood and treasure, is being invested in a failed policy in Syria when there's so many issues domestically for Iran at home. And I think one potential reason why Eisenkot was so clear about Soleimani's failure, etc., when normally Israel and the IDF are quite circumspect, is to try and put that domestic pressure back on Iran and to try and curb its regional policy.
Yeah, and he was very stark about that when he echoed kind of what's been talked about before, where this idea that Iran chose the wrong playing field in Syria, that they thought that the proximity to Israel and the proximity to Israeli positions on the Golan Heights, linking up two fronts, southern Lebanon and being near the Golan, was a strategic advantage for Iran in Syria, when actually, as he said in his interviews, Syria represented, for a number of reasons, a very bad place for Iran to be taking action against Israel. And it actually, there were reasons why that was easier for Israel to take action against, the air superiority that Israel could have, the sort of ongoing chaos of the civil war, just the general topography in Syria and what was going on there. So that I thought was a very, very interesting point. I think what would be interesting is we just moved on to another sort of military figure who's a former chief of staff, Benny Gantz, and just look at some of the politics this week. I mean, it's been a quiet week on the Israeli election campaign trail. In some senses, we've not seen any of the kind of splits, mergers, disagreements, press conferences than we have previously. But one thing that was very notable was the week began with Druze opponents of the nation state law. Many of those who are former senior military figures who were having a meeting at, I think, Benny Gantz's house, talking about the nation state law. And he issued his sort of first public pronouncement on any policy of this campaign, where he said that he would seek to amend the nation state law. And, you know, in some senses, in normality, that may not be considered that controversial. The government had already said, even before the election was called last year, that it would do something to try and recognize the special status of the Druze in order to counter that opposition to the nation state law. But he specifically said, I will amend the nation state law. And then very soon we saw an absolutely incredible reaction reaction from across the board, particularly from the right wing in Israel, who attacked Benny Gantz, saying that, you know, this proved that he was a leftist and that he wasn't signed up to those principles that the nation state law proponents represented, sort of guaranteeing Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people. I'm very interested to know what you guys made of that, having seen that play out earlier this week.
So yeah, I don't think it's all that exciting. I don't think it was that controversial either. I mean, amongst security officials and certainly former officials that will talk about politics, it's not seen as very controversial that the debt and the role that the Druze have played within the IDF and the security forces has left the nation state law has really scarred them, and that needs to be amended. So I don't think it was that controversial to say. It was even quite a neutral statement. Of course, you're absolutely right that what was predictable and amusing even was how immediately all the right-wing parties, Likud and the New Right in particular, jumped on him and were very happy to label him a leftist. I think you could probably make the assessment that whatever he would have said would have caused that reaction, that they were just waiting to label him a lefty. And that really is the worst slur that one can be called in this election. It's interesting that even apart from Tippi Livni, who kind of proudly says she's left, I think everyone else on the centre-left, whether it's Avi Gabay of the Labour Party and Yair Lapid, are also trying to shirk off the image of leftism. So there is kind of something toxic in that framing, which the right wing are very, very keen to accuse Gantz. So yes, and part of the conspiracy theories behind it is that there is a combination of the people behind this Druze rally and people who are close to Benny Gantz, who kind of engineered this as a moment that he would kind of make his first statement, even though I think he spoke for about a minute on the record, and that's it. So I think we're still waiting for him, as you say, in the more conventional form of politics, to hold a press conference to talk about a wider range of issues, so we get a further idea of what he really thinks across a whole range of topics before we can really know where to pigeonhole him.
I think what's ironic here is that when the nation state bill was passed, analysts actually said this is what the election is going to be fought over. The right is going to talk about how important it is, and the left is going to talk about how it needs to be changed. But then actually, so many things happened since then that the nation state is not an issue at all in the election, apart from the fact that this was the first thing that Benny Gantz talked about. I thought that my personal opinion was the response was absolutely hysterical. Not in a funny way, in terms of hysteria from Likud, and I think it is indicative of the fact that they see Gantz as the main threat to Netanyahu, which is on the one hand weird because he hasn't really opened his mouth at all, but on the other hand is backed up by favourability polls that we've talked about before. I agree with Richard that it's not a particularly controversial thing for to talk about amending in some way the nation state. For me, the key question will be, and I agree that the whole curse of being a leftist is being reeled out again and again. For me, the key question will be, does it work? As in, do the public think that someone who says the same things as Benny Begin and others on the nation state, when you try to tar someone, whether it's Lapid, whether it's Gantz, whether it's whoever, as a leftist, which Likud has been doing over and over again for years now, does that work when it gets to election day? Or does Gantz, by virtue of being a chief of staff, and does Lapid, by many of his statements over the last few years, are they able to protect themselves against that tarring? And that's something that remains to be seen.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I think the fascinating thing there was the extent to which they exposed how much they see him as a threat. And I think considering his party is polling in the sort of low to mid-teens and Likud is polling at 30, that they sort of revealed the extent to which they see his threat increasing. And this was only the first thing that he said. And it was, as we've agreed, it wasn't that significant. So imagine what they actually do when he gives a kind of robust and well thought through policy speech, if that were ever to happen. But I mean, it also shows, I suppose, from his side, how much he can sort of wind up his opponents by indeed saying very little. I thought it was a very interesting exercise in understanding how the dynamics will play out into the future. Okay, I think we probably need to leave it there, but I'd like to thank you both very much for joining us, and thank you to our listeners. Please review and rate our podcast on iTunes, and we'll be back again next week.